Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 17th of August. Monday at 9 is all things political. We have a lot to talk about this hour, starting, of course, with health care reform, which still is dominating the news every day. And over the course of the weekend, we'll try to make sense of what the administration, various members of the administration, were saying about health care reform. President Obama was in Grand Junction, Colorado on Saturday, saying that all I'm saying that the public option, whether we have it or we don't, is not the entirety of health care reform. It's just one sliver of it, one aspect of it. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said the public option is not the essential element of the administration plans. And then we also had Robert Gibbs, press secretary on Face the Nation, saying the White House still supports a public option to introduce competition to the insurance industry and to lower prices. So we'll be looking at all of that this first hour. Also, in Afghanistan, presidential elections are taking place this week. We'll talk about the war in Afghanistan and those elections as well. And whatever else you'd like to discuss. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our guest is Professor James McCormick, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University, here to talk about all of those issues. He has a special interest in foreign policy. He's the author of American Foreign Policy and Process and the Domestic Sources of American Foreign Policy, but of course can talk about everything, U.S. foreign policy, international politics, issues in American foreign policy, but also American domestic policy, because that's front and foremost as we look at healthcare reform. Professor McCormick, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning.
Yeah. Let's start with healthcare reform for just a moment,
sure,
because we were getting mixed signals over the course of the weekend as to where the administration is on this public option plan. Where are they on this plan?
Well, I think they're a little bit divided internally, it sounds like. As you correctly pointed out, the Secretary of Health and Human Services yesterday was talking about maybe moving away from the public option, while Press Secretary Gibbs was sort of pulling in the other direction. I think what they're really searching for is some sort of common ground here. I think over the past week or so, given the kind of protests, and we can probably talk about those and the nature of those, I think the administration is probably pulling back a little bit and trying to figure out what is really workable. I think it was telling that the senator from North Dakota, Kent Conrad, was on one of the interview programs yesterday, and he said the public option really was dead in the Senate, that it didn't have the 60 votes that would be the sort of the supermajority hurdle that would be needed in that chamber. And that he was espousing kind of cooperative kind of plan here in place of this public option. So I think it's in flux is the best descriptor.
Mm-hmm. So what's the problem? Are you never going to get more conservative Democrats to adhere to or take on the cause of a public option plan? Or is it that the president has not been forceful enough in being able to persuade them?
I think there's a couple of issues here, it seems to me. One is the ultimate cost at the time of a recession. And I was just looking before the program here at some of the cost estimates, ranging in, $1 trillion to $1.5 or $1.6 trillion over the next 10 years would be the cost of financing this entire kind of program. But I think there's a second concern, particularly among the Blue Dog Democrats and some of the more conservative elements here, and that is that this public option would morph into the elimination of the private sector health insurance, and that is seen as obviously is very damaging and challenging in terms of the quality, the range of options that are available to the public, because obviously some people can buy more upscale and more luxurious kind of coverage. And with a public option, it seems to me there would be a pressure for a common denominator, though, although there might be added, and people, much as they do with Medicare, might get a supplemental plan to cover what the public option doesn't cover. But all of that is to say would raise the health care costs for individuals.
Right. The president had a piece in the New York Times yesterday.
I saw it.
Number one, he said, there are four parts. Number one, he said, first, if you don't have health insurance, you will have a choice of high-quality, affordable coverage for yourself and your family. It will stay with you wherever you move, change your job, or lose your job. Is that true of a cooperative kind of plan, too, or is he throwing away the main part of health care reform by not having a public option? Is that what this means?
Well, I assume that the cooperative plans, and again, they're just in the embryonic stages within the Senate Finance Committee, would have to take all comers here in terms of coverage. That there probably would be, frankly, is the kind of health insurance that I have here. We have three or four different option plans that we can choose based upon relative costs, and I wouldn't be surprised to see that this kind of cooperative plan would have the same sort of thing. I mean, you have farm cooperatives certently in Iowa and in Wisconsin. You have credit unions, nationwide that are all not-for-profit operations, and they have different kind of menus, if you will, of what people can choose and what kind of trade-offs they can make. So I would suspect, although I don't want to preclude what the discussions might hold, that there would be this kind of mixture of options available.
Mm-hmm. And is it true, as Senator Conrad has suggested, that this is dead in the Senate? He just doesn't have anywhere near 60 votes?
Well, I think the question, though, is, and what he doesn't state, of course, is if they get a bill, some sort of bill passed in the Senate, get some sort of bill passed in the House, and go to conference committee and then go to reconciliation, they wouldn't need the 60 votes probably coming back on it. I mean, at least that's been some of the suggestion here. So I'm not certain, that Senator Conrad, I mean, he may be true about the Senate, but in terms of the overall process, it may be more complicated than that.
Yeah. And where do you think, this whole thing is kind of surprising to me, Professor McCormick, because it seems to me as though the American public, not all that long ago, businesses, many Republicans, many Democrats were very much in favor of taking on the healthcare system. Everybody was being hurt in some way, not having adequate insurance, having no insurance, small businesses being hurt. Where in the world is the American public on this issue right now?
Well, again, if you just look at the most recent public polls here, I was really quite, Gallup had one out this past week. And, the public is very skeptical of the Obama handling of health care. I mean, it's the one issue where he doesn't have, on the economy, he's right at teetering at even on both sides, opposed and in favor. But on health care, the public has moved in the opposite direction. And if you delve deeper into that poll, too, where the President Obama has actually lost support is among independents.
Hmm.
Which has been sort of his stalwart. Obviously, he's not going to get Republican very much support on health care policy from Republicans. But the independents look much closer to Republicans than they do to Democrats, and that's exactly reversed, not so much on health care issues, but on a whole swath of issues when you looked at the previous administration. I mean, the Bush administration could never get any independents. They always look much more like Democrats. And so Obama is suffering a little bit, it seems to me, from that middle ground. And I think, to get directly answer your question, why have those independents moved? I think the backdrop of the recession, and the considerable uncertainty about the cost of this is a driving force. Now, you might respond, and it's reasonable to say, well, these people are losing their jobs. They really need this public sector health care coverage. But I think the problem is that they also are very scared or very alarmed. Scared is a little bit, is not the correct term, but I think alarmed over this kind of cost that might be involved here.
Mm-hmm. And what about the press and all of this? You know, it's remarkable to me. I keep wondering, where's Edward R. Murrow when you need him to do some kind of documentary? Because
well,
the press,
more appropriately, Walter Cronkite.
Or Walter. Oh, I miss him. But why is it that we don't have... Finally, the press switched a little bit last week to the thousands of people in California who are waiting for some kind of health care. In Milwaukee, we had hundreds and hundreds of people show up for clinics before children went back to school in this city. It seems to me as though the focus is now on the arguments, you know, the death panels, et cetera, instead of why it is that we need some kind of reform.
Well, I guess I come back to the, you know, this has been politicized, this issue.
Yes, it has.
And yeah. I think that it has taken it out of the substantive area of the issue. I mean, I think that's where, in part, the administration has lost a little bit of ground here. Because it has been so politicized by talk radio, and on the other side, on some of the cable channels and so on, that the substantive discussion of whether it's, you know, the veracity of this whole issue over death panels and all of this cannot really get through because, you know, it is seen as, you know, as a part of a political a wedge issue kind of thing and part of a political game here. I mean, on the one hand, you have, you know, say maybe Rush Limbaugh on one side, but then you have, which I think really Democrats didn't help themselves, when you have Nancy Pelosi, you know, and Steny Hoyer writing this USA Today column. Actually, they didn't say that protests were un-American. They said that shouting down Americans, you know, was un-American, or shouting down others was un-American. But I think that the issue has been lost, the substantive issue has been lost as the politics of getting advantage has arisen.
That's too bad, because if there ever was a subject worthy of a substantive discussion, it's the health of the country.
Well, it is. I mean, particularly the cost here of, you know, the health care costs continue to spiral here. And the tragedy of having whatever the correct number is of uncovered people, 46 million, 47 million, or what have you. I mean, that is sort of... it is lost in this whole discussion.
Before we go to phone calls, and we have many of them, let's look briefly at the Afghan presidential election taking place this week. What's the significance of this election?
Well, I think it is terribly significant here, because if an election can't be pulled off that has some sense of legitimacy, it makes the task of for the future for the United States and for the NATO allies, who have staked, have quite a stake in the future of Afghanistan. I think it's really crucial that the election process, the process itself, be seen as legitimate, that there, in fact, will be significant voter turnout. Low voter turnout will be a tragedy in terms of the kind of whole legitimacy question of whether this is really representative democracy. And it'll be interesting to see if it will be really a competitive election. As you know, there are some 41 candidates, but there are two or three candidates, you know, the present president, Karzai, and a couple of his major challengers are actually former members of his government. So it'll be interesting to see if this turns out to be a competitive kind of outcome or not.
And what do you suspect the turnout will be?
Wow, it's very hard to guesstimate on that. I mean, ISAF, the International Security Assistance Force, the NATO operation, has already acknowledged that there are, you know, areas, particularly in the south, in Kandahar province and Helmand province, that they're not going to be able to guarantee the security for some of the voting. But they sort of minimize the number of voting outlets. But I think if you have in an election, because it's also not only a presidential election, but a provincial leader election here. I mean, I think you have to have 30, 40, 50% turnout. I mean, to start to talk about having a real legitimate election. I mean, it would obviously be nice to have more, but I think, you know, given the hardship of the country, I think you have to talk about those kind of ranges.
Mm-hmm. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Africa for the past 11 days, ending just a few days ago. The New York Times talked about this as her emerging style as Secretary of State, stuffing her days with what felt like a dozen events, a blur of high-level meetings, roundtable discussions, town interviews, etc. And I'm wondering if there was anything of great substance that came from this and whether or not it's a good idea for the administration. They've done it before with the president's trip to focus on Africa.
Well, I think it is important. Africa has been one of the areas of American foreign policy that administration after administration has said they're going to do something about, mm-hmm. and then have not really followed through on it. Now you had a major speech by the president in Ghana just 6 weeks ago or so, and then you had this high level visit by Secretary Clinton. I think what both the president and the secretary are demonstrating is that personal diplomacy here can be quite consequential. And given, if you will, the sort of the star quality of both the president and the secretary of state, I think it can have considerable impact on Africa and for U.S. policy. The problem is, there will be follow through in terms of, you know, fighting AIDS and providing foreign assistance here. I think that's the question. And, of course, foreign assistance at a time of recession at home is always a really serious challenge.
Right. Phone calls for you in a moment. Professor James McCormick is our guest. He is chair and professor of political science at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, and we'll be with you in just one moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Monday, Barbara Ehrenreich will be with us, author of a number of books. I think we spoke with her most recently about Nickel and Dimed. She wrote a provocative column in the New York Times on August 9th asking, is it now a crime to be poor? The number of ordinances against the publicly poor has been rising since 2006. We'll talk with Barbara the second hour of our show. Two phone calls now for Professor James McCormick. Steve from La Crosse is our first caller. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was very concerned last week because there was so little press coverage on the president's meeting in Guadalajara. I thought both the superficiality of the press's coverage and the president's response to a couple of crucial issues. He was unwilling to confront the illegal government in Honduras and unwilling to renegotiate NAFTA, and I think that superficiality doesn't bode well for having any meaningful immigration reform in the future in this country.
Well, I think immigration has been put a little bit off to the side by the Obama administration. I mean, one of the things that the administration has been faulted for is taking up so many issues at the same time here. And I think that while immigration reform policy is not dead in any sense, I do think it. I think the caller is right that it's sort of been put off to the side here, and I think it's really a function that domestic politics and domestic policy, particularly the healthcare issue, is really dominant, and that immigration issue, much like healthcare, is a very tough, very difficult issue. Either border with regard to Mexico or with Canada here, because Canada was clearly like some more action on the part of the United States, and Mexico wants I think more access to the U.S. In terms of immigration policy.
Anything else, Steve?
No, thank you very much.
All right,
thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Anne from Madison, hi.
Hi. I think that something like 62% of Americans in polls before the insurance industry and the rest of the medical industry operatives got going on Congress and holding these disruptive meetings said they were in support of a single-payer system. That is the only system that they pay for that doesn't have a middleman that works in every civilized country in the whole world and has for decades. And the reason, I believe, and I think the only, you know, the only sensible conclusion is the reason Congress is, I don't believe these polls, I don't know, you know, we never get any information about them, but the reason Congress is not able to get the number of votes needed to pass a single-payer system is that they are being openly bribed while this discussion is going on. And unfortunately, President Obama has surrounded himself with corporate types. As you mentioned earlier, the Secretary of Health and Social Services, Kathleen Sebelius, says that it's not even a public option isn't a necessary part of the final plan. And this morning on one of the Wisconsin public radio programs, there was a representative of what a group called Americans for Prosperity. I believe it's the group that, in fact, he said it's the group that put on tea parties, so-called tea parties, all over the country in April. And when I was looking for a local paper on the square, I reached into the box. This was in April, right after the rally, and I found a whole bunch of very obscene flyers published by something called the Anti-Socialism Alliance, which sponsored those tea parties. And one of them, you know, they're all, they have obscene pictures, they have obscene messages, so I can't really repeat them. But among the posters is one that has a caption saying, "You shut the blankety blank up," and they use the word, word I can't say on the radio, talking about war. "War is a real man's job. You cowardice anti-American liberals can stay home with the women and children. We'll protect America." I mean, you know, we're being brainwashed, and the public has to wake up and see what's being done to them, and they have to speak out. And Congress is being bribed. We've just got a real, we almost have a criminal cartel in charge of our public activities.
Professor McCormick.
Well, there's a lot there. Let me just say, first of all, that there has been a great deal of advertising on this issue, and we're likely over the next few weeks to get even more. There was just, and again, I don't know about the veracity of these numbers, but there was some numbers put forward in the New York Times piece just the other day that said already there's been, by interest groups, spending of $57 million on advertisements. Now, these are probably not run in Wisconsin and Iowa, at least I haven't seen them, because they're really targeting particular states. The states they identify that they're targeting are such states as Arkansas, Colorado, Louisiana, Maine, Nebraska, and North Carolina. And the reason for that, as you can guess, is that some members of Congress there are part of the Blue Dog Democrats, and also some of the senators there, even on the Democratic side, like in Louisiana, where they might be, and Arkansas, where they might be wavering in terms of their support. And the upshot is that over the next few weeks, it goes on to report that the Obama administration has mustered about $24 million in advertising, and the opponents have about $9 million in the bank. Now, I don't know about the veracity of any of these numbers, obviously, and we can kick around a lot of numbers. The real point here is that the advertising on this has been quite pronounced, although I suspect less so in some states than others here. And I think we're likely to see it. I think there's one other point, though, and the caller sort of alluded to it. The administration actually, unlike 1993 and 1994, when the Clinton administration tried to pass health insurance, they've actually co-opted some of the, you know, ARP, for example, has come out of retired persons here. American Association of Retired Persons has come out in favor of this kind of health care reform. The AMA, has as well. So there has been, I'm not sure that its interest groups tilted entirely on one side here. It is the case that there are these conservative groups that clearly are operating, and just as much as some of these other groups here.
Thanks, Dan, for your call. Dave is next from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I wanted to talk about reconciliation here, and it's just don't know if it's hypocrisy or just amnesia, but, you know, when Republicans controlled Congress, reconciliation was used a lot. The Bush tax cuts were forced through with reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
Tax Increase and Prevention and Reconciliation Act of 2005, the list goes on and on that Republicans used this reconciliation. I think that Obama's numbers possibly are going down because he's not using reconciliation. If he used reconciliation and they forced this thing through, I think his numbers would skyrocket, and I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, he, in one interview, and again, with one of the networks within the last couple of weeks, the president did say that he expects, I think it was with MSNBC, he did say that they're going to get a bill and he would not necessarily work to get Republican support. That is, he would use the Democratic numbers that he has. The problem is, and I think we've alluded to it earlier, is that he's got some recalcitrant Democrats that are really concerned about their about their reelection prospects here, which makes it more difficult. I don't think it makes it impossible to get done, but it does make it more difficult. It also goes against Obama's sort of statements that he wanted to build consensus. But I think you're right. Once a bill gets passed, public support probably will, as you say, go up. I don't know if it'll skyrocket, but it will go up because the public is always keen about getting something done, and getting some accomplishment. I mean, Americans generally have been, and you're probably a long time observer of this, they're impatient when things are not, cleaned up, whether it's in foreign policy or even in domestic policy. And so I think you're right. There would be sort of a rally effect that the president would gain if he were to get some bill passed. One thing we haven't talked about, and I don't know, this stimulated by this caller, is the whole question of whether the president should come out with exactly a bill that he wants.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that has not been done by the administration, I mean, they're taking their cues from the Clinton years, is not to put a bill out there that can become a shooting gallery. But at this juncture, these other bills have become part of the shooting gallery. It seems to me that they ought to probably take what they deem is really workable and passable and put it together and put it out as the Obama option.
And what keeps him from doing that, do you think?
Well, he had said that he wanted the legislative branch to put together a package that they think that can get passed, and I think the other thing is, as I said earlier, or implied earlier, is that he did not want the bill to become the target. If it's his bill, it becomes the target of every possible group, even including those in his own party that are unhappy.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email, Frank from Green Bay. If the health insurance companies, drug companies, and for-profit hospitals aren't complaining about the proposals, they are, by definition, not worth having. Congress will have been bought and sold again.
I'm not sure exactly. Some of them actually are on board, I guess, is the point here. Try me again on that. I'm not sure.
I assume he's talking about lobbying, money being spent to defeat this by health insurance companies, drug companies, and for-profit. And if they're involved, if they're the guilty party, if they're involved here.
But the irony is some of them have already struck deals with the administration, in terms of on prescription medicines and so on. So it's not entirely, as I said earlier, this kind of either or with some of these health care providers.
Right. But there must be concern. If there's so much concern about everybody, government becoming involved in forcing private insurers out of business,
right,
because it's going to be cheaper or whatever, there has to be a whole lot of concern. And you look at where money is going in terms of lobbyists.
Well, that's true. I mean, there's no question that there are some groups that, would become big losers. But some companies, and even the president cited Aetna at his town meeting in Montana on what Friday, I guess, that Aetna had been, was a good player in this because they were cooperating with this sort of thing. So some insurance groups, they're all interest groups, but some insurance groups would clearly be more advantaged than say some some smaller carriers here that might be left out of this. You know, they just couldn't compete against these big companies.
Right. Thanks, Dave, for your call. We, for the first time, have a couple lines open. It's All Things Political for this August 17. Our guest, James McCormick, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. And our number for you to join us is 800-486-8655. Or you can email talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Mike is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Hi.
You know, Kathleen, first I wanted to address a point that you brought up about wishing that Concraig was here or another decent reporter that could give us some facts. Bill Moyer has an excellent series on the healthcare issue going on right now on the public broadcasting. And one of them I think everybody should watch, and you can go to YouTube, I guess, and see this, and then forward that to everybody you know so that the public can be informed, is the installment where he interviewed a former executive of marketing from one of the major insurance companies. Mm. And the guy turned, he resigned and is on the other side now and giving all the information. And it reminds me so much of the anti-union thuggery that went on back in the 30s that we read about. And it's so much like that this is, it reminds me a lot of, and I always use the word fascism, but the tactics are so similar. This guy, being a former executive and knowing what the insurance companies were doing or are doing, said that Michael Moore is spot on. He didn't say he was way off in left field. He said he was right on with his documentary on healthcare. The question I have for your guest, though, is I'm wondering with the numbers, the statistics that show that Obama is losing popularity with healthcare, how many of those numbers are people like me, where I went out and hit the streets for Obama, I went out and voted for him, and I've always voted for Nader before, but I said, well, maybe this is the guy, this time I can support a wimpy Democrat, this guy looks good, and then he turns around and becomes another wimpy Democrat, And I'm wondering how many people like me are disenfranchised with the Democrats.
Progressive Democrats. Okay, thank you, Mike. I'm sure many are, Professor McCormick.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, the point about taking a look at Bill Moyer's interview with that fellow, I think I would encourage members of the audience to have a look-see at that and to get that kind of information. I think the caller makes a good point that some of those particularly on the left within the Democratic Party, have become not as enthusiastic about how much how willing Obama has been to compromise on some of these issues here. I think it was telling. There was a report. Just again, I'll use Iowa here since I'm in the area. That there was a Democratic activist from a small town in Iowa who worked vigorously for Obama. But she said that she was interviewed and she just can't get up the same enthusiasm to go back out with regard to the health policy question here. And that is also, and they talk about a meeting that she tried to organize in her home and she only got 10 people to show up. So, the caller is sort of on the mark here in terms of that there has been some erosion, if you will, sort of it reached a crescendo maybe in early November of last year, but the enthusiasm has, at least among some, has waned a bit.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Mike, for your call. We go next to Pat from Oconomowoc. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. I just wanted to point out that, I agree with your guest and the fact that this notion that, it's all corporate interests and lobbyists, that's the downfall of the bill. I think that's completely untrue. I mean, I want to repeat that in 93, the AMA was the main group that collapsed, the Clinton legislation. And that's probably the one group that Obama had to go out and convince and cut some deals with early to make this happen, and he did do that. I think the bottom line is Democrats have supermajorities in both the House, the Senate, and obviously the presidency. They could go ahead and pass single-payer tomorrow if they want. The fact of the matter is these town hall meetings is showing them that there's a lot of public cynicism and a lot of people worrying about a public option. The fact is a lot of people like the private health care. And whenever you have a competing public interest against a private interest, people are afraid that eventually, if not right away, they will be forced onto the public option, or if they quit their job, they won't necessarily get that private plan back. And I think that's more what's driving President Obama to try to reach some type of compromise with you know, Kent Conrad in the Senate for some of these co-ops, which, as a Republican, I can definitely get on board with. And I think that's more what's going on here.
Professor McCormick.
Well, I think the caller, you know, makes a good point, is that there is a concern about people losing their, people that have insurance, about losing the quality of care that they presently have, and sort of the unknown about what this public option would be, and would it be truncated or not. I mean, the whole question is here, how do you, the reform effort is about saving resources here and saving money and presumably having more efficiency in terms of the healthcare system. But does that also mean at some juncture reducing the level of services here? And I think that's what the caller's alluding to.
Do we have any idea, and is this one of the downfalls of the administration in trying to sell this to us, do we know how we're going to fund all this? Do we know? I know we're going to look at taxes on people who are more wealthy, but how do we?
Yeah, well, the House bill is written into it, that's awaiting a vote here. That was passed by the committee that the House Democrats have put together would tax people with making more than $280,000 a year, mm-hmm. and couples making more than $350,000. So it would be the high end income folks that would bear the brunt of this. Business taxes would also be increased here, and of course people would be businesses that don't offer insurance would have to pay a penalty and so on, so there would be this kind of transference that way. What the President Obama has said is that he would tax, and he said it even as recently as his meetings in Montana here, those that raising taxes on those with more than $250,000 annually here. The Senate Finance Committee proposal that has been bannered about, you know, these are the three Democrats and three Republicans who are sort of trying to hammer out sort of some middle range. This is where Kent Conrad is involved. They would go and put a tax on or a premium on those folks that have very expensive health care plans. I think the number that I've seen is around $20,000. If your health plan, costs with your contribution, with your employer contribution, $20,000, you'd get some taxes on that. So in other words, that would be used to fuel what they're proposing is this kind of cooperative idea. Because even the cooperatives that were started, as I understand them, would need some government money, startup money from the government, to get the cooperatives going here,
right.
So they could get into place and to be competitive. I frankly find the cooperative idea, attractive, particularly if the single-payer idea is not politically viable, because the point of introducing, as the president said even in his op-ed piece yesterday in the New York Times, entering some competition into the insurance marketplace is, I think, very crucial in terms of wringing out inefficiencies.
All Things Political is what you're listening to this Monday, and we have this conversation, not this conversation, it always changes, but this is a regular feature, All Things Political. Our guest is Professor James McCormick. He is chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. Our phone number, thanks, Pat, for your call. We have one line open, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. The second hour of our program this Monday, Barbara Ehrenreich will be with us, author of Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America, and This Land is Their Land, Reports from a Divided Nation. She recently authored an op-ed for the New York Times titled, Is It Now a Crime to Be Poor? She'll be with us the second hour of our program. All right, back to phone calls. Christopher from East Troy is next. Thanks for waiting. Hi, Christopher.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning.
Hello.
Good
morning.
My thought is when the war was going on, there were millions of people all over the United States protesting in the street, not being too disruptive. Some millions of people over the world, the media was horrible at reporting on this. Now we have a few hundred, maybe a few thousand people disrupting half a dozen so town halls, very disruptive, ignorant, and the media keeps it on a news cycle for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what's more important is having health care for everybody or killing a bunch of people in a sovereign nation. And in these health care town halls, there's a fellow who carried a weapon outside of one where the president was going to be. Now, when Bush was speaking at town halls or meetings, they had free speech zones off to the way so people wouldn't be disrupted. It's so hypocritical of this liberal media to not report the truths. And other than that, I would like to have your guests comment on what Sybil Edwards said this last weekend and what came out about that under oath.
Who said?
Sybil Edwards, the most gagged woman in America, who was an FBI translator after 9/11 and talks about she was testifying under oath about court in Ohio, there was a Representative Jean Schmidt was accusing her opponent of lying, and Sybil Edwards had to testify in that about the Turkish lobby infiltrating Congress and paying off, which was, if you look under Sybil Edwards, you'll get the whole story. I can't tell you all. Look under bradblog.com, and he will have most of the information.
But All right, Professor McCormick.
Well, I'm not familiar with Sybil Edwards. I'm sorry about that. It sounds like, particularly if it's talking about Turkish lobbies, it's something that I should take a look at. But I'm not familiar with the details, so I'm not in a position to comment. I do think, I sort of agree with the caller that there has been not this kind of consistency in the reporting. I mean, there clearly have been some people that have been disruptive, but the turnouts here in Iowa that I've seen, and I happen to be up in Wisconsin the previous week, you know, and I know there was a meeting in, Green Bay or whatever, at Congressman Kagan, is that where they're one of these first episodes of very enthusiastic, or maybe more on the part of some of the people. But the meetings in Iowa have been extraordinarily well attended, large turnouts, and for the most part, the reporting of them have been that they've been very respectful here. So I think that you know, that there does need to be more of that statement in terms of accurate portrayal of the number of people that have turned out and the actual behavior of the crowds, because I think we're talking about relatively few. I mean, and to the question of they're organized, my view is that they're organized, and I see nothing wrong with that. It's certainly part of freedom of assembly under the First Amendment, and as well as freedom of speech. I don't think that you should obviously speak over people, but as I always tell my students, freedom of speech doesn't mean anything until somebody says something you disagree with. Then you can see if you really are in favor of freedom of speech.
Thank you, Christopher. Scott from DeForest. Hi.
Hi there. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that the Democrats cannot get through a real reform in health care this go-round. What would be wrong with a fallback option that would say, if your insurance company drops you, or you're one of those poor people, as Kathleen's had call in before, like I remember a guy and his wife were both diabetic and he was self-employed, and no insurance company would I mean, he said they laughed when he asked about coverage. Or, let's say, a third category of people for whom the insurance industry would ask, say, over a certain percentage of their income, which would make health care nigh on impossible for those people to get. What happens if what would be wrong with a policy that would say, if you fall into any of those three categories, you at that point would become eligible to be picked up by Medicare? Now, I understand that there's an economic impact that that would have in terms of raising the cost of what it is involved in providing Medicare to people, but Medicare is covering seniors, not exactly a low-cost group in the first place, and you at least get these people some help. And I would think that even the Republican hardliners would be in a pretty awkward position, right, arguing that the uninsurable in the country, who nobody wants anyway, would suddenly get coverage.
Well, I think it's a wonderful idea. I think maybe you want to throw in there, too, that, you know, that Medicaid would be available by, you know, raising the, or lowering the standards in terms of eligibility. That is, in terms of, I guess raising would be the proper way to express it. In terms of income levels, that they would these individuals be eligible for Medicaid, Medicare. They probably what you're really suggesting, they probably have to lower the age, although it would be probably contingent, as you suggested, upon condition. Now the problem with Medicare, of course, is that it has the same financial kind of challenge that some of these reform efforts would have in terms of when it would run out of funding. But I think it would be probably on the cost side. Well, not probably. It would be on the cost side a lot less than some of the plans that are being advanced here. No, that's, I think that's a good idea. And I think personally, in terms of trying to cover those that do not have coverage, I mean, that seems to me is really the crucial, or that can't afford coverage is really crucial, and that's a good target and a good starting point here.
Professor McCormick, when do you imagine there will be some kind of vote on some kind of bill? A lot of people are saying this is way too fast, you can't move this through this quickly. Do you anticipate something happening by fall?
Oh, yes, I think so. I mean, the president has said that he will go even with just the Democrats by December and so on. But I would think that they would, you know, that the president wants something in September. I think that that's too ambitious. But I would think October or November, there is likely to be a vote. And the question will be, I think, and sort of come back to where I was talking earlier, is whether the president will set forth a bill himself, or say weigh in that he tilts, say, towards the Senate bill, or he tilts towards the House bill to you know, sort of focus more fully the debate. I mean, he come back after recess and say the public has had input, and now it's time to take the messages that we received and to put forth a proposal. I don't think it is advantageous, frankly, to have a series of different bills out there because, you know, that gives you more shooting targets.
Sure.
For those that want to slow it down.
Thanks, Scott, for the call. Craig is next from Viroqua. Hi, Craig.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Gene, if you would listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, you would know that another way of funding, I heard it from a guest, I was amazed, I almost fell off my chair. He said that the way they were going to fund another avenue for health care was to put a tax on high sugar soda, just like they do on beer and alcohol and tobacco, alcohol, a sin tax. What this would do, I couldn't believe it. It's beautiful. It will open the door to tax junk food.
Well, I didn't hear that on Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm afraid. But maybe Kathleen did.
I didn't hear it either, actually. I'm sorry. But we do a lot of talk shows, so
yeah.
We have a lot of ideas every day.
Theoretically, I'm very much in favor of clamping down on junk food. Would that raise enough revenue? Be interested in seeing what the revenue estimates on that. I know there's lots of junk food, lots of soda
right.
Around. But I'd be interested in having the CBO do a cost estimate on that.
It could raise a significant amount of money, I would think, when you look at the...
Well, what it also would do is, on the other side, it would be in terms of preventive care. Talk about preventive care that people could take in terms of their own lifestyle. That it would make a great deal of difference.
Right, it sure would. When are the Afghan elections? Are they Wednesday? Is that
Thursday?
Oh, they're on Thursday.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to watch those. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Professor McCormick. I enjoyed the hour.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Professor James McCormick, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. He's written several books on foreign policy. And let me tell you what they are. American Foreign Policy and Process, and also The Domestic Sources of American Foreign Policy. He teaches... classes in international politics, U.S. foreign policy, issues in American foreign policy, comparative foreign policy, and obviously knows domestic policy pretty well also. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Just a reminder, we do have All Things Political every Monday at 9 o'clock, so we talk politics all week, but this hour is always what's been happening politically over the weekend and in the days before, and it's been all things healthcare related for quite some time now. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. News is coming up in just a moment from National Public Radio, and then Barbara Ehrenreich will join us. So please, stay with us. It should be a great hour. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.